Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
WrestleNomics Radio is presented by yours truly, Chris Harrington, your host, at Mookie Gunn on the Twitter, coming to you live from St. Paul, Minnesota, here on February 11th, 2017. Hope everyone can hear me nice and clear. I'm doing the best I can today. We are here to talk about WWE financial results. They published their 2016 full year results. They have given us, of course, their Q4 results. They had the conference call, gave us their input for what 2017 would look like. And on Thursday, they had that call, they had that discussion. And I've been trying my best to recover from some illness, recover from just having a really bad scratchy throat. So this is going to be a little bit of agony for me to talk to you all, but I really am enjoying it. So I'm looking forward to talking to everybody. Be on the air for at least an hour. If you want to call in, the number is 646-668-2171. Be happy to talk to any of the WrestleNomics pundits that I normally get or any other fans that just happen to be out and about tonight. Nothing better to do than to call into a financial wrestling news show. I am home alone tonight. My wife is over in Chicago doing a mock court thing. And so that means it's just me and the dog. So if I suddenly disappear at any moment, it's probably because the dogs are barking like mad and I put it on mute. But otherwise, we're just quietly sitting at home on a Saturday night, the night before the Elimination Chamber. And we're getting ready to talk about WWE 2016 results. And I've been spending the afternoon here just kind of going through all the results and looking at the information in there. And it's probably most important to started off by just giving you the actual data points. If you haven't looked at the results yourself, I always highly recommend people read the annual report. That's the 10K that they file. Go to sec.gov, look for Company Finder, type in WWE. Then up in the box, it'll probably be one of the first documents. But if you're still looking, you can type in 10-K. And that's going to be the annual report. And that I always find gives you a really good sense of what's happening with the company at that time. And is a somewhat honest look at the company, I find, in terms of some of their disclosures, especially around risks to the company or around why certain segments are up or down. A lot more cut and dry than when you look at the press releases, for sure. So the company finished with record revenue, $729.2 million for 2016. So that's enormous. I mean, last year they're at 658.8. So they've gone up, you know, another $60-70 million, which is an impressive feat for sure. It does say a lot though, that revenue top line growth is going to always be high because we're converting people from being, you know, $45-55 customers as pay-per-view to being $10 customers on the network. And then moreover, the television rights fees are escalating year over year over year over year, and they're guaranteed to escalate regardless of what happens with ratings. So of course we continue to see that progress there. Now, just to put in perspective, operating income for the year was $55.6 million, and net income is $33.8 million. And OIBDA, the number they like to use, which is operating income before depreciation and amortization, is $80 million. So $80 million is a record for WWE in the sense that they haven't hit $80 million since 2011. It's been below that. It was 52 in 2011, 63 OIBDA, 30. They had the year of negative 15.5 because they took a huge hit the year they launched the network. Last year, they're up to 61.6. And this year, they're at 80.1. But it's important, you know, it's tough to dig into the financials and see this maybe from the annual report, which only gives you a three-year look. But if you look a little bit deeper, you'll very quickly notice that, oh my gosh, well, back in 2010, they did $477 million, but they made OIBDA of $94 million. Back in 2009, they had $475 million in revenue, and they did $91.5 million in OIBDA. 2008 was $526.5 million in revenue, and they did $83.4 million in OIBDA. And 2007 was $485.7 million, and they did 77.7 million on OIBDA. So basically, they're tied with where they were in 2007. So it's been a decade here to get back to kind of square one, which is interesting. And when you think about it from a percentage standpoint, that means they went from making almost 16% OIBDA back in 2007, 2008, or is it even up to almost 20 in by 2009, 2010. And lately, it's been down in the single digits. And this year got up to 11%. Probably the two-year average is closer to 10%. So revenue way, way up, but profits are not way, way up. Profits are essentially just where you were a decade ago. They're up from the last 5 years, but it's transforming. And so when they say next year we hope to hit, you know, 70 million on operating income and hit 100 million OIBDA, well, they've hit 80 million on operating income before in 2010. So the 100 million OIBDA will probably be a record for them, but they've been pretty close to that before. So it's still transformative years here, which is of course part of the guarantee here is they get revenue coming from the TV contracts that will just increase year over year over year. And as they get just more in ability to monetize their live events. And that was definitely a theme of this year. So from a rating standpoint, they always start off their key performance indicators with their ratings. And it's important to note that for Q4, Raw was down 10%, down to a 2.22. And SmackDown was actually up 17%, up to a 1.9. Meanwhile, USA Network as a whole was down 8%. So Raw is still declining faster than USA Network, though the USA Network average is only 1.18. So, of course, both Raw and SmackDown much, much higher. On a top 25 cable ratings, ratings are down 6% for the year, and that puts us at about 0.75 for the what they call the top 25 cable network. So they're trying to show the picture that Raw is still way above in terms of number of eyeballs on the property compared to anything else, which is true. But it is slipping faster than the USA trend, slipping faster than top 25 trend. And SmackDown going live, having the brand split, is showing some great returns. So at least from that standpoint, they are making some business decisions that are helping them on SmackDown. And so it's interesting. And, you know, someone even brought up the question of, do you think in a few years from now, NBCU would be interested in expanding the amount of programming they have, you know, even add wrestling on Wednesday, maybe with an NXT and a 205 block or something of that nature. You know, 2019 is a long ways off. So I'm a little dubious that, you know, they're going to have as much of an appetite in 2.5 years from now than as what they have now. But, you know, never say never. It could even happen in the meanwhile before then. Just as they continue to add. And, you know, one of the big messages, in my opinion, coming out of the 2016 financial report was really the rise of NXT. As, you know, they got a little slap on the wrist during their conversations with the SEC and amending last year's report. And then also in this year's report, really calling out how much revenue are they getting from NXT? How much revenue are they getting from the live events at NXT that they're doing? And so that was really interesting to me. And so, you know, the rise of NXT could suggest that maybe there would be a situation where they would look to put it on terrestrial television. That said, that's a really tough decision, right? Because part of the whole draw of the network is to put this premium, unique content on there. And once you dilute that by putting it back on the television, well, that's going to possibly cut in. And unless you're going to get some really good rights fees for that, then I could see WWE really being reluctant to basically shoot themselves in the foot again in that situation. Speaking of shooting themselves in the foot, one number that we got in the final, the annual report that we didn't have already was the pay-per-views number. We were able to find out that pay-per-views this year did $12.6 million. That's down $8 million from last year's 20.6, which was already down $25 million from the 2014 number of 14.2 million. And then, of course, in 2013, they still had pay-per-views as an active service, and that's when it was 82.5 million. So when they still had pay-per-views actively, they did about $34 million OIBDA, which is about a 41% margin on 3.8 million buys and getting, you know, maybe 20, 21 bucks a buy at that time when you factor in the fact that they're getting a split, of course, with the cable companies. Now, that number by the next year, when it was only a $45 million business, so it was down to about 2.29 million buys, and it was about a $20 ASP average selling price. The next year you know, the business fell in half to 20.6. That was 1.4 million buys, and that's about a $15 price tag. So if you were to think this year at 12.6, I would estimate that somewhere probably north of 850,000 buys, which is just, you know, coming off a base there of, you know, almost 4 million a couple years ago. They're at a fifth of that. And of course, most of those buys are coming from overseas, so it's at a much, much lower price point. You know, we're looking more at that $12 to $15 average selling price in terms of the value that WWE is getting. So pay-per-view down to about 12.6 million. But the number I would kind of stick in your head there is that 40% margin. So they were getting a 40% margin on pay-per-view before they went there. Now they have the WWE Network. And the WWE Network this year did $168.3 million compared to $138.8 million the year before. And then on their launch year did 69.5. So we're up another almost $30 million year over year. And the difference there being the OIBDA on the network is much, much, much lower than the OIBDA was on the pay-per-views by themselves. And so this is kind of an important piece to kind of just, you know, reflect for people. The OIBDA on the network is about $43 million. So $43 million, I'm doing, open up my calculator right now, $43 million to go into a total of 180.9, because that's the combined numbers, about a 24% margin. So you're going from a pay-per-view business that was delivering almost 40% margin to a network business that's delivering a little over 20% margin, so almost half as much. So that's the really important point that I think is lost sometimes when people say, why don't we put the WWE television on the network and just go it alone? Or why don't you change this over, that over? And the difference is you need twice as many people as what you are getting on either the television or in what you were getting for, especially pay-per-view, to make up that same profit number. And that's hugely different there in terms of what's going to happen to that business. And so that's why you need 4 to 5 million people probably on the network to might even be ad additional just to make up that TV money that they're making right now. WWE Network, in their documentation, they talk a lot about what do they consider a competitor. I thought that was interesting. They say, you know, we consider the subscription digital services from Amazon, CBS, ESPN, HBO, MLB, Hulu, Netflix, NFL Network, Nickelodeon, Showtime, YouTube, and many others. They never mention, I'm dying here, folks. They never mention UFC anywhere. You know, even when they talk about competition on one of their later pages, they just kind of say, oh, we face competition from sports leagues, from college games, but they never talk about UFC or the Fight Network. Of course, they never talk about New Japan, and TNA is not nowhere to be seen, literally. WWE Network, of course, has about 7,000 hours now, up almost four times as much as they had in February 2014. But as I was saying on the Wrestling Observer Live, when I got to do a quick spot with Mike Sempervivi and Brian Alvarez, I don't know whether or not you could correlate the spending and the hour gains of what's on the network to the gains of people. You know, most of the gains that happened in the first 2 years was just from the fact that they were literally moving it to new countries. Now we're getting into the point where you do see a lot of churn of people kind of intra-country making decisions about drop it, bring it back, drop it, bring it back. But what was fascinating, I think, also was just seeing that they did not think that they're really going to have any kind of a paid subscription bump between January 31st and March 31st. And, you know, all the numbers that they're going to get are going to come into Q2, into the WrestleMania quarter. And it just says a lot about, you know, you're putting Goldberg, you're putting Lesnar on this stuff. And yet, you know, you're just getting what you always got, which kind of impresses me in a certain way to say, you know, doubling up on the number of pay-per-views we're doing per month. It's hard to say whether there was really less attrition coming from that. And maybe that's something that you can call in with your thoughts if you have any questions or thoughts on that. It's 646-668-2171. Moving on, like I said, the network segment, the OIBDA this year was $43 million. And I should coach that a little bit. There was about $15.5 million that this year they moved from a television cost to a network cost. So if you take that out, then your OIBDA goes up from, of course, being 24% OIBDA up to almost 32%, because you're looking at it being closer to maybe a $58 million segment which is more comparable with last year, where it was almost $50 million, $49.5 million. Again, this has to do with these, quote, certain costs and expenses that are shared between networks and TV segments. And I think this might even be partially due to some of the new programming they have. So when you have a 205 Live or Talking Smack or The Raw, you know, those aren't really assets or costs that should be put against the television segment. They should be put against the network segment. And so there's a lot of that going on. And the same way, they're recycling a lot of the television programming, like the Total Bellas and whatnot, onto the network at this time. So when we look at TV rights, that's, of course, you know, WWE's shining star and the hurdle that they also have to get over come 2019. And that hurdle is essentially that right now they do $241.7 million. And that's going to be the revenue right now. Someone is tweeting me and suggesting I add sound effects. And it's funny that he mentions that, because I was actually thinking about doing sound effects originally when this was just going to be a pre-recorded thing and adding in the bam, 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 bam after each revenue hit here. So the dogs might provide the sound effects tonight. That's for sure. And again, I want to remind everyone, our first hour of WWE's 2016 financial report, brought to you by WrestleNomics Radio, is brought to you by Sprecher Root Beer. Sprecher Root Beer, brewed in Wisconsin at a brewery. It's the root beer that your dad would give you. Sprecher Root Beer. Got one right here. It's also brought to you by Hot Water. Hot Water. Drink some. Keeps your throat soft. TV rights, $241.7 million. That's $120 million OIBDA, $120 million profit. And that's shocking when you really think about that. That's a 40% margin that they're getting right now. Actually, a 50% margin that they got on TV, 43 if you take that 15.5 I was just talking about that the network had to absorb. So if you look at kind of years past, that they were absorbing that, and that the network segment used to be only a 36 to 40% margin business. And now it's up to almost a 50% margin business. And it's just going to keep growing for the next 2.5 years here. So that's just incredible here. One thing that, you know, I thought was interesting is when they talked about how much they spend on programming. So they said they spent $28 million this year to produce non-live event programming for television. That's the Total Divas, Total Bellas, two seasons of Total Divas, and then also includes the network programming that they do, like Holy Foley, Camp WWE, Swerved Season 2. And, you know, $28 million is actually a lot less than I would have thought those shows would have cost. So in some ways, that's not so astounding. They did say that this year they think they're going to spend anywhere from $10 to $25 million on programming. And it's a little bit like Netflix, right? Where Netflix spends money to put all this original programming on, but at the same time, they already have your money because you're a subscriber. And so some of it is just trying to figure out basically how to keep you as a subscriber over time. So it's really hard to judge, are these shows making their buck? Are they worth it? You know, certainly they are decent vehicles for keeping people associated with the company. So, you know, of course, the Foleys being associated on Holy Foley gives them a lot of exposure and keeps that relationship fresh and new. But it is questionable sometimes whether or not, if pay-per-views are the big draw, should they just concentrate on that? We're going to be surprised if we make it through this, guys, but I'm excited. I'm also glad I got a tweet. You can always tweet me at mukigana.com, but I'm glad I got a tweet, because when you're doing these kind of shows, you have these moments of panic where you're like, what happens if, you know, I'm not in fact recording? What happens if I'm not in fact broadcasting to anyone? And while that's no different than, you know, how I spend many of my days just talking to myself in a haze, it does frighten me sometimes when I have to go back and do this again. So I'm glad to hear that at least some people are out there hearing the words that are coming out of my mouth. If we go back, actually, TV programming, I should also point out, is down this year. So they said they spent $28 million this year. It says they spent $36.2 million last year. So in some ways, I guess we can be happy that, you know, they're not blowing their budget on that. As we go through kind of some of these other segments here, we might be surprised at some of the profit margins that they see on things, specifically the home entertainment section. So home entertainment right now They did $13.1 million. Last year, it was 13.4. The year before that, it was 27.3. It used to be a much more profitable business, for sure. And, you know, this year, they still put out 24 home videos. They shipped 1.6 million DVDs and Blu-rays, down from 2.1 the year before, and down from the number of releases, too, because they did 28 million a year ago. But you can see that home entertainment is also being sold increasingly by digital content. And I think that's making a big difference for WWE, because we see actually that the margin went up this year, even though sales were down by 300,000. The margin was up almost 700,000. And so we saw a 40% margin on this business. So again, when you're thinking about the network and you're thinking of other things, home entertainment, the old school Blu-ray DVD business, is still worth almost twice as much on a margin basis than what the network is. Thankfully, I'm not going to be alone on this podcast. I do have a special guest joining me. And in fact, this special guest I'm going to bring on the line right now is from area code 716. I'm hoping this is my friend Brandon. Brandon, how are you doing?
Hey, this is George Berrios.
You know, George, are you super serving me by coming on to my podcast today?
I am. Actually, George is not getting his haircut tonight. This is Brandon.
That makes sense. Yes, that was. I was very amused that granularity appears to be gone finally from Berrios' playbook, but they were very clearly fixated on this phrase "super serving" and the super serving that they do of the WWE universe.
Yeah, and did you hear that the big wheel keeps on turning?
Yeah, I did catch that one as well. I enjoyed that. Yeah, Vince was pretty animated on this call here. We're, of course, talking about the conference call, the investors call that they do after each one of these earnings releases. And Vince, out of the blue, kind of a props to nothing, just suddenly said, oh, and by the way, the 100,000 people that we had at WrestleMania, that includes ticket takers and ushers and food people. And we didn't actually have a paid attendance of 100,000 people. And so that was a real shock to me.
To say that. Yeah, he said nobody asked him about that. That was just, you know, Vince usually does these opening statements at the very beginning of the call, and he volunteered that information for some reason.
Yeah, one thing that jumped out to me is when I was going on the SEC website to look up, look for the new filings, I saw that there was a whole bunch of commentary that they had where they were actually revising their 2015 annual report based on the letters that they were sending back and forth with the SEC, and basically being told to be more granular in their disclosures about, you know, what was live attendance, what was NXT's role on that live attendance. And so I almost wonder if someone gave them that kind of nudge that said something about, are you misleading investors when you talk about 100,000 people, but it's not 100,000 paid? And so they felt like they had to put that out there in a subtle way.
I didn't get a chance to look at that. I know you tweeted about that and I saw that. So they added that information about the NXT live attendance. Was there anything else that they amended?
Not much. I haven't actually myself spent all that much time looking at it again today. But it was just a couple little comments that they had back and forth. It was very unusual, and I thought that was really amusing. But you bring up the NXT, and I thought that was really interesting this year that they said, you know, NXT had 189 events this year. They said they did 188,000 in paid attendance, which when I did the math, it's 37 and some change for a ticket. And that means they averaged about 1,000 a show, which means they were making about 37,000 a show. And that means that they made about $7 million this year compared to last year, 120 shows.
Florida shows that they run, which draw, like, who knows, when they're running in Largo or wherever they go, they draw probably like 200 people, because the number, they gave you the total number of events. So like, they're not doing that many. They're not doing, what was it? Like 100? How many events again was it? So that I've written about this. I should know, but it's a high enough number where it's not just the non-Florida events. It's gotta be the Florida events too. And somehow that average still comes out to be close to 1,000.
Yeah, that was really surprising to me too. Is I'm glad that they said paid attendance, because there is that confusion over it. And, you know, those Florida shows, technically, I guess the small ones, I think they are paid. It just would be the Winter Park shows at Full Sail that might not be paid. So we would have to really get granular on this. There's that word again.
Yeah.
Try to figure that out.
I'm sure we could find out about that easily. Because, you know, there's people on Twitter have gone for the NXT TV tickets. I want to say those are paid tickets, but I'm not totally positive.
Exactly. Just kind of putting in perspective, a year ago it was 120 NXT events, 92,500 people, $36 a ticket, 770 people a show, $28,000 a show, and that would be $3.4 million in revenue. So they basically doubled their revenue year over year from a little under $4 million to $7 million. So
yeah.
At that point, I was like, wow, $7 million, that definitely puts NXT way ahead of Impact, puts it probably, you know, it makes you wonder where ROH kind of stacks up against it at this point.
Yeah. Do you think it covers the cost of the performance?
No. you know, just looking at that, I mean, it's a good question. I was looking at the corporate and other spend. And so in 2011, they spent about $103 million on corporate and other. And in 2012, it was $116, 2013, $127, 2014, $150, 2015, $172, 2016, $178. So not all of that is performance center costs, but a portion of that is. And so, you know, when I'm talking about $7 million of incremental revenue, no, $7 million does not cover the number of contracts that they even have at the performance center, I bet, on an annual basis. I mean, a lot of guys are working for $50K, but, you know, you have your Nakamuras and your Joes and your Rudes down there, and I guarantee those guys are making six figures or more. So, it's definitely a mix. And yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting, but I just think that there's finally, I think, a real basis to say, okay, we should be breaking out these NXT numbers, because once you're a $7 million revenue stream, you're larger and you're impossible, you know, you're larger than a lot of smaller brands and things that are going on right now. You're larger than, you know, you're half the size of the whole entertainment
business.
You're
larger than all those companies that they don't include in the competition section of the annual report.
Exactly. Other things that, you know, I was looking at was just how profitable licensing is. You know, they make $49 million on licensing, and it's almost a 56% business. And that sounds great until you realize that they used to make 70 to 80% on that business. And then when that THQ bankruptcy happened, basically they moved to Take Two and they ended up with a much lower video game rate. And they even said that this year was lower on the OIBDA because, quote, increased talent participation expenses. So I don't know if that means that they put more people in the game and they had to pay more people out, or because there's greater kind of unrest about the fact you don't get pay-per-view money anymore, that they jacked up how much money they give out to people in royalties.
Yeah, maybe.
But I can go through all the numbers, all the pieces, but I would love to get your take on it. What were some of the things that kind of jumped out to you as you went through the annual report?
Well, as far as the whole earnings release goes, I think the WrestleMania 32 admission was kind of the most exciting. Well, within the first 10 minutes was pretty exciting, because who knows why he admitted there was less than $100,000. Like you said, maybe they had talked to somebody and it was related to that, to the amendments that they had to make to the to their annual reports. But it looks like, you know, we know pretty well that they're not going to come close to $3 million. Probably ever.
I think that's a kind of a big talking point here. So this year they ended at a total number of, was it 1.48, something around there, for where they were on December 31st, and they had another quarter where they gained 347,000 people and they lost 388,000 people. And so we still had that enormous churn that is still a question mark of how much of that is just people literally canceling and signing back up. But at the same point, those are paid subscribers. So those are people that are putting it on a credit card. So it seems silly to say that those are the same people that are just trying to get the free trial all the time, right?
Yeah, I think there's probably some gaming of the system going on, you know, but I think there's most people, I don't know, just don't want to be bothered with it. They have to go through the ordeal of, you know, creating a new email account. Like, we all know people who, you know, aren't that tech savvy, that they're not going to, you know, just create another email account to save $10 or whatever it is. So I think there's some of that, but for the most part, it's probably unique.
So we had a good question here on Twitter. Someone asked, my good friend Ken, Kenny H from Gainesville, asked, what price point would justify moving Raw and SmackDown to the network? And that's an interesting question. Like I said, it would take, you know, 4 or 5 million people at the current price point. So when you're doubling the price, you know, to $20 a month or $25 a month, the challenge is, of course, we do expect to be some erosion from the people that just are not willing to take that. Historically, though, we have seen that wrestling fans are highly price inelastic. So my guess is you could probably get it to $20 or $25 and you would be in a good place. I don't know whether you could ever get to that same margin structure that the NBCU has right now and to have the eyeballs on it to keep to be at that right percentage for viewers. I don't see it until a couple years from now where you just have enough people adopting streaming services in a way that you could make find a price point where it works. I think in some ways TV overpaid. And so there's no way you can come up with a mathematical equation for what the network has to be to get to replicate that revenue, even though the TV numbers were under what they originally thought that would be. What is your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think WWE wants to or should want to leave a bundle, you know, a bundle that has things like Raw and SmackDown in it, because then that's going to be, you're going to be losing access to being a part of this more mainstream bundle where people can discover you. So maybe someday WWE Raw and SmackDown won't be on the USA Network anymore, but they should still want to be part of some greater bundle, whether it's who knows what the future will bring, whether there's some sort of Netflix bundle or whatever it is. They need to have, whether it's some YouTube thing, they need to have, you know, be part of a larger world where non-fans can become fans.
And you talk about the bundle, and that was something that came up at the end of the conference call where Brandon Ross from BTIG asked basically, well, you know, a lot of people offer their services through Amazon. And so you can get Cinemax, you can get HBO, you can get lots of different paid channel subscriptions through the Amazon platform. Why aren't you on the Amazon platform? And basically they said, well, we don't get enough of our consumer information from that. So we're not happy with the revenue sharing agreement and with the consumer information metrics we get. And so that was, I thought, a really telling thing about WWE's kind of thoughts on bundling with people, because specifically they're asked about the Crunchyroll bundle where they had done some kind of out of blue promotion where they just suddenly said, hey, if you want to sign up for Crunchyroll, you can get a certain number of months free on them. And I think they're also based on BAM, but that was an intriguing kind of conversation about just kind of the reluctance that WWE has, again, to being at an arm's length to what their consumers are watching or what their consumers are consuming or who their consumers are. And that seems to be an obsession with this company right now, because that's one of the main reasons they use for why they dropped pay-per-view back in the day.
So because if they had gone, if they sold the network through Amazon, they wouldn't get all those analytics, is what you're saying.
That's what that seemed to be what they were implying as, you know, I was listening to that part of the call, is that my thought was that they were saying that, yeah, they don't have a way of being able to, you know, micro target people anymore. And it's even questionable. Yeah. I don't know whether they get the viewer metrics of, you know, what were they consuming and when and how. And of course, that's been one of the big investments this year for WWE, is that they have really tried to push up their data analytics and their consumer engagement. And I was rather shocked when that number came out for January 31st, saying there was only about 18,000 free WWE Network subs right now, considering that they sent out that email blast to everybody about the free 3 months that you could get if you signed up. Right. So it seems like very few people are taking advantage of that. Yeah, and that's, I think, gets back to your original point about, is 3 million a viable number? Because it seems like we're getting to the point where we no longer have large groups of people sitting in the free trial bucket, even at a very interesting point of the year. So does that imply that there's just, you know, a ceiling of maybe 1.7 million fans worldwide, less China?
Yeah, or maybe 1.8. I was looking at things today. I didn't notice that the free trials were that low. That's as of January 31st, where there's 1.5 paid, and you said like 70,000 free right now?
I think it's, I honestly thought it was 18,000 people free. Yeah. I'm going to pull up the report right now just to check. But that was my recollection as I calculated it out.
Yeah,
they had a much larger number on December 31st. And so that was the other part where I don't know if that's, Yeah, whether it was just that the increase came from the fact that, or I'm sorry, the decrease came from the fact that come Royal Rumble, all those 30-day subscriptions that were coming from Christmas, you know, gift cards and whatnot, that all expired. And so by Royal Rumble time, it was gone. Let's see here.
If that's
You
the
know, it
case,
was
then you
actually in
only
the press
converted
release.
10 or 100,000, 100,000 is pretty high. That's more than 70,000.
Yeah, and what the other thing that I thought was interesting during the call was that essentially they admitted that they probably will still be running a free trial during WrestleMania this year. That, you know, they didn't learn their learn their lesson, you could say, or they didn't feel like it was a bad outcome, which surprised me a little bit because I guess in my mind I thought it was not a great outcome from last year's free WrestleMania numbers. And I do think a lot of people are misreading the fact that they moved over some of the expenses on from television to the network, and so it makes the network look less profitable this year. If you move those expenses back so you can have like to like year, you'll see that they were more profitable this year as a whole. But still, they weren't wildly profitable by any means. And it doesn't look like even all those free WrestleMania moochers, you know, necessarily moved over and became paying subscribers in mass numbers.
Right. So last year, WrestleMania, they reported like 340,000, 370,000 free subs during day after WrestleMania last year. So we think free subs are going to be way lower for WrestleMania this year.
It will be, I think, but it's not like they're getting rid of it. Yeah, right there it says there's free. Yeah, I finally found the presentation. It was part of the earnings presentation, and there's a slide that says as of January 31st, 2017, there's 18,000 free subs right now,
Wow.
and there was 19,000 last year. So for whatever reason, it's really low right now, and that
19,000
surprises
at
me
the
just
same
because.
time previous year.
Yeah. So that was kind of a
Okay.
surprise to me, just that we've dropped so much even from the end of December. But like I said, I think a lot of it is the holidays. You probably get a lot of people trying it out for the first time, and they become paying subscribers for a little while during this time. Obviously, they're going to continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they just added $200 million of financing. And I think that's so fascinating that the company basically took a loan out for 200 million, put it in cash, and then started talking about on the conference call that some of it might be because they approached some people and people said, "We looked at your balance sheet and you look kind of cash poor. We don't want to partner with you." I thought that was really interesting that they kind of said it might be for strategic reasons of that sort that they were doing this kind of deal. But the stock price has been just flying for the last 2 days ever since the earnings came out. So the company is
Yeah.
definitely got to be happy right now with the way it's looking. What were some of the other things that you took away from the conference call or from the annual report that you were looking at in terms of 2016 results when it comes to attendance?
Well, I don't know about attendance, but you saw on the key performance indicators, AVOD views have plateaued. You saw that, right?
Yeah, AVOD. So AVOD, for those that don't know, is ads supported video on demand. So essentially YouTube video. And you know, the digital media segment is basically where they get their money for advertising on YouTube. And they even said in the annual report that they got about $4.9 million more this year, just specifically from YouTube revenue. And so, yes, this segment is profitable. It does about 4.6 million in profit and does about 27 million in sales, but it's a 17% profit segment. And you know, compared to home entertainment at 40% or live events is much higher, and it's probably the lowest, you know, percent segment of anything except for the network. So they're continuing to put a lot of emphasis on digital media. You know, it says in the report, the role of social media by fans and by us is an increasingly important factor in our brand perception. But you know, YouTube and Facebook is not necessarily driving a ton of money into their coffers today.
Right. I was surprised they even put Facebook, in those notes where they say this, this is what AVOD is, YouTube and Facebook. Have you ever seen an ad on a Facebook video?
An ad, no, but it's possible that they're in. I've always heard that they were part, you know, when they were doing that video streaming things. I don't know how Facebook pays for that, whether that's who makes money off of that in what way. Because they were yeah. bragging that they were part of, you know, the companies that got to do that. But the stock is up to $22 right. bucks a day now. And just on Wednesday before close, it was at 19.3. So it's up, you know, quite a lot of money right now. I was really surprised at how positive everybody kind of took the news of how the company was doing. For investments at the yeah, please go.
When we hear, you know, Berrios do these talks where he says, the money will, you know, where the eyeballs go, the money will follow. And digital media seems to me like the most obvious place where, like, maybe someday we'll get so many YouTube views that we'll make so much ad revenue from those YouTube views that maybe that will become, I don't know, a prime stream of revenue for them. And about a year ago, it looked like who knows where the ceiling is for AVOD, because it was just going up and up like at an exponential rate.
Yeah.
And now it looks like maybe we're at the plateau here. And so how are how's the money going to follow the eyeballs now? I don't know.
And you bring up a point too, that Laura Martin from Needham, who longtime listeners know is such a big fan of mine. She always calls in. She always wants to talk to Vince. And Vince. What she was talking about was, Vince, great numbers, guys. We're doing it.
Congrats.
Laura kept asking about what are we doing with the AVOD for the network? What are we doing with the roll ads before the network?
Right.
And they basically admitted that they were going away from that because they didn't find that it was getting great penetration or what. And I think that's a reality of just saying, well, if you only have 1.5 million people and you've already made them pay for your service, maybe it's best not to annoy them with banner ads or, you know, pre-roll ads. And instead, it's better to try to make the money off the YouTubes of the world in terms
right.
of things.
Kind of
and just
that the, there be more ads on the network.
Also says something about what they must be getting for rates, because it's not like WWE is choosing to do this because they think it's the way to super serve their customers. It's, you know, obviously a strategic decision of if you're making minuscule ad revenue and it's something that is being counted against you possibly when, you know, you ask subscribers, why did you quit? It probably makes more sense just to forego the extra ad revenue if you're just not being offered the big money deals. So I found that really interesting,
yeah.
too, that we had that conversation during the call again. They talk about investments, of course, every year of what are they spending their cash on. So they mentioned they spent $1 million on a fantasy sports content provider, $1 million on a subscription-based sports media company, which we all believe to be Flow Slam or Flow Sports, I should say, and $250,000 yep. in a virtual reality platform operator. And then the year before, they spent about $500,000 on, quote, a live event touring business,
reality.
Which I believe was that.
Whatever those headsets were, that there are pictures of Vince and Stephanie looking around in a couple of years ago. Remember that?
Yes. I think that's one of our favorite, you know, pictures to use on Reddit. You'll see all the time is Vince in the VR headset.
Right.
They talked about the lawsuits, of course, and, you know, that their CTE is basically what they're being sued over, that they're being sued over royalties. In their corporate and other segment, they talk about basically they're spending a whole lot of money on lawyers right now, and that is true. But, of course, they even take a little jab at Kairos at one point in the statement where they say, we believe all of these claims are being generated by the same lawyer. And, of course, they are confident that they will prevail. And for the most part, I think they're definitely going to prevail in the CTE suit. The royalty suit is being thorny. I think we're at a fundamental disagreement about what it means to have a contract and what that contract applies to or doesn't apply to. And so once that ruling comes down to whether or not basically Buff Bagwell can take his WCW contract that talks about new media, or whether he can take his WCW Inc. contract, which was the WWE organization he signed a contract with, whether or not those contracts apply to today's WWE network, I have no belief that they're going to really prevail. I wouldn't even be surprised if at some point, you know, they just throw a little bit of money and make him go away. But I think they're at the point now where they're just going to fight this one out. It seems like it's too far for it to just go away quietly. But I think that's going to be the one.
You know, this. if they lost that case, that would only pay out to people like Bagwell who have those old contracts right now, right? That's not going to be like retroactive to like where the people who are signed today are going to be able to get royalties off the network.
Well, it kind of depends. They're using a very broad argument. And so they're saying, here's a person who has standing and here's why. I think they would love to, you know, kind of grandfather everybody in. And so I think that attempt is going to fail, to be really honest. But you never know. It's really open to a lot of interpretations. Like I said, I don't think it's going to go very far, but I would say that lawsuit, probably even more than the CTE lawsuit, is the one that the boys in the back are probably more would care more about, is the, you know, who gets the royalties from the WWE Network discussion is a lot more interesting to people today than talking about, you know, who's paying for traumatic brain injuries. So that I just thought was interesting whenever you look at the lawsuits and just kind of how they talk about things. They talked about their corporate and other section, and they said, we spent $4.7 million in professional fees for company-wide strategic initiatives, staff-related costs of $3.7 million for increased headcount, talent-related costs of $2.6 million in support of talent development, and investments of $1.6 million in global branding. So I have no idea what $2.6 million in talent development means, whether that means we added so many more people to our roster that we had to pay them $2.6 million. And, you know, that's Bobby Roode and Bobby Roode's music, or whether that is, you know, putting more trainers. Is it the cost of the PC as a whole, and just, you know, the fact that they're bringing more people down there, what that means. But I found that interesting that, again, you could say
is
corporate and others expanding
talent costs from between 2016, 2015.
That's, you know, my gut is yes, but, you know, talent is a very broad word also. So I wonder, does that, we consider talent to mean wrestlers, but talent could be a lot of different things. It could be independent producers. It could be the trainers at the performance center. So it would be interesting, but that's my belief, is that essentially they're saying their cost of serving that went up by $2.5 million last year, which kind of goes with the idea that, you know, we've talked about, which is they have a lot of people under contract right now. I think they gave the number of 185 active superstars under exclusive contract. And then they'd say they're highly trained, motivated, independent contractors, which I always find funny to say you have someone exclusively under your contract and they're an independent contractor. And I guess contract right. and contractors go together. But the fact that it's exclusive kind of makes me laugh. What did you make of their desire to say that 90% of their active current main roster stars, such as Kevin Owens, Charlotte Flair, American Alpha, Alexa Bliss, and Sami Zayn, came from their developmental league?
Right. Well, this is the narrative that's been kind of going around for the last few years since NXT really became what we know as NXT today, is that they're gonna, with the exception of maybe a few people like AJ Styles, they're going to sign these people up from the indies or wherever they came from, and they're going to put them in NXT, and then will be in NXT for a little while, and then they'll pump them out into the main roster, and then they'll be able to say, look at what we've done with NXT. We've generated all this great talent. We developed them and taught them how to look into cameras and things like that, and now made them into WWE superstars. And ignoring the fact that there's this other, you know, what Triple H calls the indie undercurrent out there, that, you know, where these people were quite talented already to begin with. Because obviously
and that was...
don't know about that stuff.
No. And I thought it was funny that they said their talent development, 40% of their recruits are coming from outside of the U.S., increasing ability to create content for global markets, which, of course, is funny, is to say, well, is Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens, are they considered outside of the U.S. talent, or are they considered U.S. talent because they were, you know, coming out of Ring of Honor or something? So I'm always amused by that. But it's interesting to see the branding. I always wonder what they consider to be from NXT. So, you know, Chris Jericho goes down and does a match in NXT. Is he now from NXT, or are we actually talking people who spent their time down there? And who is the 10% of the roster that they're saying was never in NXT? Obviously Jericho, Undertaker, Brock, I guess, technically, though they could say he came from their developmental territories. So I'm just wondering what that 10% is.
Right. You have to sit down and look at the roster. I don't know. I hope by NXT they just mean NXT or FCW, and not like Randy Orton and John Cena came from OVW. So that's developmental.
Yeah, see, that would be my – yeah, exactly. If we say it's 185 and we're talking 10, 10%. Obviously, it's on 185 on the main roster, so it's a lot less than 18 people. But I'm sure we could brainstorm 10 people really quickly without much challenge. In terms of international breakout, you know, the business is still 74% North America, 11% UK, 7.5% Asia, 6% kind of Europe, except for the UK, and then less than 2% Latin America. And that's always going to be the number that gets me is, you know, back in 2010, they were 4% Latin America, and they continue to pull back from their Mexico market. And I get that you can make a lot of money overseas internationally, but it also seems to me like you're way underserving the opportunity that you have in Mexico right now. And I guess it's just the lack of a star that they really can put a face onto it, isn't it?
Yeah, El Real is gone. Kalisto is not really getting over. Sin Cara was a mess. Oh, they still have a Sin Cara. But, yeah, who did, we were waiting for La Sombra to get over. And got SEN online.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was funny too when they mentioned
where
the talent came from.
Is the style of, you know, the lucha style something that doesn't translate as well to American wrestling, or more like the type of American wrestling that WWE wants, rather than maybe letting them do their own thing more.
And when you see the list of what countries they say our talent from outside the U.S. came from, they mentioned China, Japan, Australia, Ireland, Scotland, and Poland. So they don't even mention Mexico once, which, again, I just think it's a little bit of an oversight. And then maybe it's a stretch, but for me, when I heard that Lucha Underground is going to show up on Netflix, I think it's the middle of February that season 1 and 2, something like that, is going to be available for on-demand viewing on Netflix.
15th was the date going around.
Yeah, I think that's huge in terms of you're talking about a Lucha Libre-style wrestling product. You're talking about a product that's showing up on Netflix, and it's not WWE. And so it seems to me like, hey, you might want to realize that there's an opportunity here if there's something going on. But that's just my take. And it's clear from them, from a strategic point of view, either the country managers are much better in the non-Latin American countries, and that's why the emphasis is there. But, you know, they're spending all this money and this investment in trying to hire Chinese talent right now. And it seems to me with the disarray that's going on in AAA and all these other places that, hey, there's an opportunity there and it's right up to your doorstep. But I guess that's not where they're going.
Yeah. I mean, if we look back on attendance, I've been looking at some of the old, I think we're going back all the way to 2006 or 2008, these spreadsheets that you've made where you got all this attendance data and they're trying to make some sense out of. And something that we can look at, which I don't know off the top of my head, is so did Rey Mysterio make a positive difference on Mexican live events when he was around?
Yes. The short answer is yes. They did monster house shows when they started going to Mexico. Well, it's possible with the right star. And so I remember when Dr. Lucha used to be on Figure Four, he would talk about, you know, the upcoming Mexico tour and how important it was just for even what match Ray was going to have. And it sounds so comical to me at the time where I was like, well, nobody cares what the house show lineup is. But he would talk about, no, in Mexico, they really do want to know who is Rey Mysterio going to wrestle that night. And, you know, of course, then when Alberto Del Rio was with them, he would come and they would have his father as Dos Caros, you know, seconding him and all sorts of other things. So they put a lot of effort in and they got a lot of money because, you know, they had that kind of rich teenager demographic for a little while. It went down over time, but I still think there's opportunity there.
I think even in Japan, when they did those NXT shows in Osaka, and they went to Tokyo last, they went to the Sumo Hall last year, or I guess, anyway, they went to Japan and they had cards announced in advance. Because I think, you know, especially when it comes to Japan and probably Mexico as well, the fans follow it differently or take it in a more sports-like manner than American fans do, I think. So yeah, they want to see
that's
the card,
a great
of course.
Point,
whereas,
yeah.
You know, whereas here in the U.S., you know, people are just like, oh, it's a show. Oh, it's a house show. Well, who cares? It's gonna be take your kids and everything. It'll be a fun night, but you know, you don't really care about what the card is.
One thing that I think I've defined WrestleNomics Radio to be is the fact that I talk at length about WWE Studios, and I'm not going to let them off the hook on this one. because it has been going on for years and years and years. And so this year, WWE Studios did $10.1 million, and they lost $200,000 on OIBDA. Last year, they did $7.1 million, and they lost $1.5 million. Year before that, they did $10.9 million, and they made $500,000. Year before that, they did $10.8 million. They lost $13 million. The year before that, they did $8 million, and they lost $5.5 million. The year before that was the year that they just, like, everything fell apart, where they did, like, $21 million, and they lost, like, $30 million on the revenue because they took all the impairments. But this year, they released five films, four of them on DVD, one of them in the theater. It was ridiculous. It was because it was before they changed their model of basically doing just the direct to DVD stuff and just going to the making partnerships with people. It came on like all the Condemned and all the other films where they had done a lot of the financing themselves. But this year they released Countdown, Scooby-Doo and WWE Curse of the Speed Demon, Interrogation, Eliminators, and Incarnate. I don't know if I remember anymore. I guess two of these films I had an idea about, right? There's the film about the bomb, and it has Rusev with the gun, and then there's the Scooby-Doo film. Those are the two I remember. But I didn't even realize that, you know, three of these other films happened. What I was fascinated by is, what percent of their revenue do you think? I doubt you saw this number. What percent of their revenue each year comes from last year's films?
No idea. Revenue.
So what's funny is
$5 million.
So less than that. But what's funny is, so this year they made $10.1 million. $3 million came from the films they released last year. That other $7 million pretty much came from films that came before 2015. They make almost no money the year of the film releasing it. It takes a very long time for them to recoup anything. So it's very funny where, like, last year they did $7 million and they made about $2.5 million from the prior year's films. And then I discovered in 2014, they made $4 million just from the movie The Call. So I know for a while I kind of ragged on the fact that they only had like a $1 million stake in The Call, but it ended up making them so much money. That's the only year they made a profit, was basically because Halle Berry. So if they should induct anyone into their WWE Hall of Fame celebrity wing, it should be Halle Berry, because she's the only person who ever made the WWE Studios money besides John Cena. And The Miz, I should mention. The Miz is the other guy. The three people, it's a triangle of success. Halle Berry, John Cena, and The Miz. You put them in a movie together, it'd be incredible.
And just don't let Ric Flair induct her into the Hall of Fame.
That is true.
You know, these direct-to-video releases that they're probably getting them distributed on, I don't know, maybe Netflix or Hulu or who knows what over the years. So it's not just like, here's the movie, and within the year it's done or something like that. I could see these B-rate movies that just constantly get distributed and recycled for a few years after they come out. Does that make sense?
But still, they say they have $27 million in capitalized film production costs. And that's 32 release films, six films completed but not yet released, three films in production, and one film in development. And I just think about how many millions of dollars that they've poured into WWE Studios over all these years, how little return they've had, how little prestige it's bought them. And then you think about something like, you know, the UK tournament and the cost of something like that and the ability they've had to leverage it. Because if there's one thing that excited the investors this time around, I should say the analysts, most of these people aren't actual investors. The analysts this time around was the UK tournament. Everybody wanted to talk about it on the conference call. Like, it was, you know, you'd think Tyler Bates was the second coming of Christ, the way that they were so excited about him. So I was really intrigued, and I can't
the idea that, well, we've got this UK tournament, maybe they're going to make a deal with Sky Sports and they're going to have additional, you know, actually distributed and televised program in the UK, which will mean more TV rights money.
You know, we're getting back to that investor fantasy booking world, just like we did before, where it was the, what if you sold $200 million to Viacom and you did this or did that? And so it's just entertaining to me when that happens. But hey, it happens. So it's always possible. I mean, I thought it was really.
We've got World of Sport on what's the channel in the UK that they're on, ITV, and we've got, you know, What Culture doing stuff. So I don't know. Maybe the TV industry in the UK might take it more seriously. Who knows?
You know, that's it's kind of a segue. I wrote an article for What Culture, and it was actually a two pager. And so one page was about the house show attendance, and I'll get to that in a second. But the other page was just about how awesome it was to be British, because Tyler Bate, was the only undefeated person in January for like WWE television, where he won Tucker, Jordan Devlin, Wolfgang, Pete Dunne, and a NXT win over Oney Lorcan. Jack Gallagher went like 5-1 that month. Neville was going like 5-1 as well. So I was just really amused that being British apparently is the only way to get pushed right now. And Nia Jax was the other person who did really well in January.
The British wrestling scene is on fire, man.
Yeah, and I think that's really been the big takeaway. Is it's funny to see, just the turmoil that actually happened in 2016 between Flow Slam starting up and between TNA completely revising itself and the UK getting television, UK having all these different companies. And none of that comes up when you're talking to investors about what is professional wrestling going to look like in the future. And they focus on, you know, such different things. And it's always fascinating to me, right? Because it's not the topics that, you know, I think, are shaping the industry from that standpoint. Obviously, there's a lot of financial things shaping WWE, but I think sometimes there's trends happening out there right now. And if you're really clued in, you would be asking them about this. But of course, you know, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about it.
Right. I wrestle with that sometimes, you know, because I question myself whether we're so far in the bubble that we think this stuff really matters, and WWE tries to project this image that none of that other stuff does matter. Only WWE matters, and they're so high up on the mountain they can't see anybody else down there. I don't know. I think maybe it's somewhere in the middle. I think some of those analysts, somebody should have asked them about Flow Slam, either this call or the previous one, because the Flow Slam story is real. I don't think Flow Slam is about to do anything serious in the immediate future, but, you know, there's a real, you know, business situation there where I think WWE was unhappy that they're doing pro wrestling. I don't think they knew that when WWE invested the money into Flow Sports, and now all of a sudden they have a relationship with WWN, which WWE was kind of, you know, forging an informal relationship with Gabe Sapolsky and WWN. And, you know,
absolutely,
heard all that stuff in the Observer about how what WWE offered to try to maybe buy out the WWN contract in exchange for them, quote, being nice to them. That is WWE to Flow Sports. So, yeah, there's a lot of weird things happening. But in the really big picture, I don't think Flow Sports is about to become a real competition and a real threat to WWE. Maybe not any more than they would say major sports leagues and other forms of entertainment that are maybe on television the same night are a competition. But it is, you know, the product is similar.
And to me, that's where it's really interesting, is it's to say they have 18,000 free subscribers right now, right? So they have 18,000 people that they're trying to convert into WWE Network subscribers. And then they have hundreds, if not, you know, millions, but hundreds of thousands of people that are non-subscribers or lapsed subscribers that they want to win back. And I don't think you're losing a lot of those lapsed subscribers.
But they're not currently subscribing, you're saying.
Yeah. Like, I know I have a friend right now who's listening to the show, and I know for a fact he's a great example of someone who for a while had the network. Yeah. And he gave up on it. You know, he took a break from it. And so it's just like people like that, you know, they're out there, and I don't think they're going out and they're pursuing the Flow Slams of the world. But I do think it's kind of like when you have a really great product and you have no distribution. So you have a great product, no distribution, and then a major brewery wants to, you know, sell your beer. Well, you know what? You're going to sell so much more under that other backing than you probably were going to be able to do yourself, unless you kind of did a grassroots efforts and really got big. Same thing happens with the Flow Slam. That's a way that WWE could acquire wrestling fans and be able to do something with them by kind of working in that space. So I do think it bothers them in that sense that, you know, it's money, it's people who are willing to spend money. And when you think about free trials right now being down to 18,000 people, I guarantee you Flow Slam is in the thousands of subscribers, and, you know, that's a marketplace that they'd care about. I don't think they want to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on it, but they definitely don't want Flow Slam to be getting Ring of Honor, anything like that, for sure. So there is a give and take and a push and a pull that's coming with that, for sure. One shining note in the annual report, I think, was WWE Shop. And I don't know if a lot of people kind of caught this, but WWE Shop was up to 771,000 orders, up from 590,000 yep. orders a year ago. Year before that was 426 orders. Year before that was 320. Year before that was 307.
Up and up for the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, and so they had basically maxed out at about 320,000 orders a year in 2013. And what they did is they added Amazon UK as their European kind of distribution arm in 2014. And since then, it's exploded. And they even said that they increased their distribution channels, including international territories, continued marketing efforts, and a broader assortment of products offered. The increase in the OIBDA this year was a percentage of the revenues was due to leveraging our fixed costs and improving fulfillment processes. And that is the most boring thing you can talk about on a wrestling podcast, is how fulfillment rates and fixed costs of logistics for a merchandising operation went well. But working for a company, a CPG type company, you know, consumer product goods, I can just say, I think that guy is probably the hero of the year, is the guy who grew, you know, $2 million of profit out of the shop sector by increasing orders by that much, but still staying profitable. And it says a lot about, you know, just kind of the opportunities for efficiency that WWE has, and that, you know, they're good at wrestling. People can argue that to death, but that's what they are. They're a good wrestling promotion company. The challenge they have is when they're in all these other streams of revenue, and they're not always the best at that. And so sometimes it makes more sense to partner with an Amazon of the world and just let them do all the logistical stuff, and you just take the money on the back end rather than, you know, fighting it all, every battle yourself.
So is selling things on Amazon a new phenomenon for WWE?
It's a European, they do it only in Europe as the fulfillment partner. And yeah, I think it's helped a lot. And again, you know, people always ask me, do you have any merch numbers? Because they want to prove Roman Reigns is not a draw, or Roman Reigns is a draw, or whatever it is.
Did you read the Google shopping thing I wrote?
No, I didn't. Please enlighten us about this. And again, you know, I don't think I ever properly introduced you. We have on the line here, Fightful.com, the person who live tweeted from the Fightful Wrestling Twitter handle this time, Brandon Howard, a longtime WrestleNomics analyst and writer. They are, but I feel like, you know, it's an easy introduction. So you've been writing a lot of articles, and I'm assuming this is an article you wrote for Fightful.com.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, I wrote an article, just some research spreadsheet that I've been working on for a while, looking at, so I look at Google Trends a lot, which is just something anybody can do, that you can go to, I don't know, Google, the word Google Trends, and you'll see it. You can type in any word, any person's name, any organization's name, and you can get a relative view of the progress of Google searches. So you won't get an absolute number. They won't tell you this is X number of searches. It'll just tell you on a standardized 0 to 100 scale. So whatever the highest point is will be 100, and whatever the lowest point is will be 0. And so you can look at that, and you can look at one search topic, and then you can put in up to like 5. So I went through the trouble of like entering every WWE roster member of note and like exporting it to an Excel spreadsheet just for the year 2016. And so, okay, so by the way, you can look at Google searches, and then you can look at other things like Google image searches and something else, but I wanted to look at Google shopping searches. So this is, you know, when you go on Google, you can hit that shopping tab, and you can search for whatever merchandise you can imagine. So in theory, this is the measurement, in theory, of people searching for, you know, products related to name your favorite WWE superstar. All right, so I've got them all collected in a spreadsheet to see, well, who's got the most Google shopping searches. So in theory, hopefully, this will reflect who's selling the most merchandise. So at least give us a suggestion about it. And the results tell you that it's like John Cena way above everybody else. A few rungs below him is Roman Reigns. And a few rungs below that is everybody else, including like AJ Styles. It's like number 3, which I thought was really impressive considering the small amount of time that AJ Styles has been with the WWE. You can, if you probably, if you Google, I don't know, WWE Google Shopping, Fightful, you'll find the article pretty fast.
Oh, that's a great example of, and this is something that you have really kind of, I would say you, me, and David Bixenspan have spent a lot of time just kind of reminding people that there's a lot of great free resources out there that you can use to find information about professional wrestling. So be it, you know, well, some of them are not free, like Pacer, but the Court Records Online are there, the Freedom of Information Act are there, and then, like you say, all these Google tools for using proxies, and they're good as anything else.
All that Google stuff is your guys. I just read and become baffled. You guys are doing a great job.
But, you know, I think the thing that's interesting, too, is the Loot Crate that WWE has started doing and trying to follow that in terms of which superstars they're putting in that to see kind of what direction are they trying to go with it in for appeal. And definitely AJ showing up, Dean Ambrose showing up. I was really disappointed with my first WWE Loot Crate, and so I ended up walking away from it. And then when I did a Twitter poll, very few people were doing this Loot Crate, but almost nobody quit besides me is what kind of my Twitter poll suggested. And so it's been interesting seeing things like Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose and AJ really being pushed in that, and not so much say the Roman Reigns of the world, just to kind of say they, I think they have a better idea of at least who their audience is for those kind of collections. And so it'll be interesting to see if there's any kind of similarity. Same with John Cena. There's not a lot of John Cena stuff going into that. So I've been finding that really intriguing. And we're already into our second hour here of WrestleNomics Radio. I just want to remind everyone, the WrestleNomics Radio is sponsored by Build-A-Bear. Build-A-Bear Workshop, now offering Beauty and the Beast, Beast and Belle Bears. How do I know? I just bought one for my wife. And that will be her Valentine's Day present. And I might just be naming objects that are in the room with me right now, and these people might not actually be sponsoring the show, but you'll never know. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt, but you got to get your plugs in, you know?
Yeah. So you're mentioning about how you got people who sometimes they want to know, can you give me any merch numbers to find out, you know, because they want to confirm or deny whether Cena or Reigns is a draw. And another thing I found really interesting in that Google Shopping article was that you look at AJ Styles. So I was really blown away by this. So you look at AJ Styles, you can look back, going all the way back to 2008 with Shopping. So you look at, you know, go back to the beginning of 2008, and it's like, you know, this line graph is like really low. It's really close to the bottom of the graph. And then he debuts in early 2016 at Royal Rumble, it shoots up. So I'm thinking, you know, you think of AJ Styles as this guy who came into WWE, who is, you know, this indie guy. This is a guy in TNA for many years. These guys are respected as, you know, one of the best wrestlers in the world. He had the run with New Japan. So it's kind of when it went into WWE, a lot of people were very skeptical, probably myself included, that, you know, is WWE really going to push this guy who is a star on the Indies, a star in Japan, who's got a southern accent, who's short? You know, is Vince McMahon really going to get behind this guy? And, you know, and here we are, at least that before the Royal Rumble this year, he was WWE champion for, you know, several months. So WWE has taken him seriously. So I figured, you know, why did they accept AJ Styles and maybe not somebody like Daniel Bryan? Why didn't they get behind Daniel Bryan as quickly? So the point is, you compare the Daniel Bryan shopping metrics to AJ Styles shopping metrics, and like AJ Styles was like way above anywhere that Daniel Bryan ever came close to. So it makes me think that if I can see this, they've probably got much realer, you know, much more serious metrics and analytics to look at, and that maybe they, you know, we complain sometimes about how well they're pushing Roman Reigns too much, or they're not pushing this guy enough. I would bet, even though there's still a self-fulfilling prophecy involved, right? You know, does the guy who you give attention to drive metrics, or, you know, or vice versa? But maybe it's not just as simple as whether or not Vince or creative are listening to the crowd. Maybe they really got metrics, you know, to support things like giving Roman Reigns the type of presentation that they've given him.
I agree. And that's something I've talked about, because you listen to the conferences like I do, and you'll hear George Berrios slip little things in about that. And sometimes it's like he's too clueless about wrestling as a whole to yeah. know these things, that this is too subtle to say. So he'll say, like,
John
I remember him mentioning
Rollins?
we brought Yeah, Sean Rollins. But the, you know, he talked about we brought Sting in because people started searching for Sting when they got their WWE Network subscription. And I think there's something to that where, you know, they have metrics that say things like, hey, Bill Goldberg's going to be worth a lot of money to you. And then you start to look at it and you say, oh my gosh, he's worth a lot of money to us. And so it's intriguing because you do have those challenges. Like I say, we don't expect the WWE Network to really grow substantially between now and the end of the quarter. Obviously, attendance has not been blowing off the charts this year. But, you know, people will ask, is Brock Lesnar worth the money he is? And I think they're looking at these metrics and saying, well, you know, that's going to be part of it, is that, you know, there's other metrics that help a lot. So it just, I always find it intriguing.
And I'm sure that they've got things like, not just like analysts related to the network, but they have things like, you know, the real merchandise stats that, you know, they know who's selling what merch, you know?
Absolutely. And, One other,
and still, like, I think there could be a, you know, how much of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy? Like, if we give this guy lots of prominent television time, you know, is it like, of course he's going to sell merchandise? And if we gave that opportunity to somebody else or shared that opportunity with others, would you get, you know, in aggregate more revenue, you know?
So we'd be remiss if we did not also talk about the unconfirmed elephant in the room, and that, of course, being Linda McMahon and her bid to head the Small Business Administration. I haven't talked about it so much, but I did put in some Freedom of Information Act. Yeah, Defender of the Little Guy. I did some FOIA requests to the SBA about Linda McMahon, and I got back a bunch of documents this week that all said, really? We have nothing to talk about Linda McMahon, and that we have no record of a professional wrestling organization ever using SBA funds, which was my other question to them. But I watched the full hearing that they had in the Small Business Administration hearing with Cory Booker and everyone else. Did you watch that hearing live?
I did. I guess the most interesting moment was in Tammy Duckworth. And for the most part, it was just people are pretty positive about her, you know, whether it was Democrats or Republicans. I guess the most interesting moment was when Tammy Duckworth, the senator from Illinois, asked her, or didn't really ask her, but mentioned having a talk with her in a meeting before the hearing about, you know, issues with WWE's 1099 contractor status, and there was a mention about, you know, monopolies, with WWE being, you know, the dominant pro wrestling company in the world.
Yeah, and for those that don't know, 1099 status is another way of talking about independent contractors. And so basically the heavy use of independent contractors, not having contracted employees, i.e. people that don't have to get health care benefits through their employer, is specifically what she mentioned. And then she said monopolistic practices of WWE. Yeah. And we've been asking, you know, you sent a note, I think, to her office asking for information, haven't heard back. We found constituents of hers. We had them send notes to the office. And so far, I don't think anyone's heard anything from Tammy Duckworth's office about. Yeah. So we're still hoping that we'll get a follow up at some point that will say, probably an email that will be just a stock email saying, thank you for contacting us. We are always concerned about the working rights of people, and we're fighting more every day, you know, something really innocuous. But in the end, by the committee, Linda McMahon was voted 17-1 to move ahead in the process. The most interesting part also probably was when, out of the blue, kind of a props to nothing, Cory Booker from New Jersey just started cutting a promo on her and said that Triple H looked small and weak, and maybe it was time for him to go to the Senate gym with him, where he could give him some triple help. And and that Stephanie seemed more intimidating than Triple H did, which it was just so weird. It was surreal. It was very surreal. And then, of course, he ended up not voting for her.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. was he the one who also mentioned that he was... I went to wrestling and went to NWA wrestling events when I was growing up.
So Cory Booker didn't vote for Linda McMahon, and I think it was mostly a visibility thing where he was trying to position himself, where as being opposed to a Trump nominee without it actually stopping the Trump nominee from moving forward in this case. So I could be wrong on that, but that's kind of the optics of it that I took away. The other person was the rep from, I think, South Carolina, a Republican there. And he specifically did mention going to NWA and other things and being a big fan. And more or less, I mean, he was about a one sentence short of quoting Matt Stryker and saying that he was marking out. But it was interesting for sure. And so her confirmation got held up pretty quickly because there was a lot of fights going on over the other nominees, you know, Betsy DeVos and Rex Tillerson and Jeff Sessions. And now that those nominations have basically gone through, I highly suspect that she will be confirmed as SBA administrator. It's not a very high profile position compared to almost any other nomination. And there's almost no women in Trump's cabinet. So I have a feeling that, you know, she will get a little bit more visibility than maybe a normal person who's an SBA administrator would get. But I also don't expect to see a lot of groundbreaking things from the SBA these next couple of years. So it'll be really interesting. Yeah, I actually realized
they paid enough
that
for it,
I am an SBA. I am a small business owner.
You are.
I run a small business. Yeah, I run an improv company here in town. So technically, yeah. I have my own LLC. I am a small business owner. So it's time for me to start getting some McMahon time, FaceTime. Maybe I'll invite her to come up to Minnesota, like everywhere else she's been invited.
Would you recommend an indie promotion use the SBA if it was starting out?
I would love to. I think we would all love to know what the SBA is. I think until Linda McMahon was nominated, 99% of wrestling fans had never heard of it. They do some money grants. Yeah, they were big. After Hurricane Sandy, they did a lot of work in basically giving a lot of people like bridge loans and whatnot for disaster relief. So they have been involved in a lot of that, or arranging low cost or no interest financing for things. And then, of course, they're always about helping people deal with government contracting. So the fact that, you know, if you want to be a government contractor, it can be a lot of hoops to jump through, and the SBA can try to help you, you know, especially women minorities apply for that sort of thing. But there's a lot I don't know about what they do. And so I'm actually kind of interested to find out more. So who knows, maybe in a weird way, Linda McMahon's nomination is going to help my business acumen in the end. So I'm happy about that. And Mike Sempervivi has been actually doing some great job of kind of just writing little freelance articles about Linda's work there. And so I do highly recommend people check out Sempervivi on Twitter and look up some of the articles that he was writing, because he was doing some good coverage. And I feel that Wrestling Observer deemed that it was too political to kind of include straight up Linda talk, that if it had nothing to do with wrestling. Oh, really? And so he didn't have a place to kind of put it. So it just kind of lived out there on his own. Yes, it was by Mr. Google, who was a doctor. And so that was what ended up happening to it, just because he'd put the time in, but he didn't have anywhere to put it. So it's sometimes tough to find a publisher in this day and age. I did find a publisher when I was talking about the house show records for January. And one thing that really shocked me when I looked at the house show records was that for January, SmackDown averaged 3,700 people for house shows, where Raw averaged only about 3,200 people. So this is not the TV tapings, but for the house shows, SmackDown actually beat them. And if you think about the fact that John Cena is on that show, it makes sense. It also helped that they ran a place like Hidalgo, Texas, which they drew 4,800 people for. But they actually averaged 3,200 people for those Monday night house shows, where SmackDown is going up against Monday Night Raw. And that just astounded me. So when people ask me, does it make sense for them to run a house show on a Monday night? If you can average the same amount of people that Raw is averaging on their other nights that they're running, I would say yes. If that number drops down to, you know, NXT levels, where, again, we're talking about they average less than 1,000 people, and they do a lot of shows that are less than 1,000 people, when you really take the whole number.
And that average Florida shows, they only draw a few hundred, but yeah.
So it just kind of shocked me that I was like, SmackDown is actually beating Raw on the house show circuit. But the difference comes when you get to the actual TV, because on TV, Monday Night Raw does about 7,800 people, and Tuesday Night SmackDown does about 4,600 people. So we're back down to those SmackDown numbers of, you know, 5,000 people at a TV taping, and that's not great. Because you really do need those TV numbers to be a lot higher to make good money, because you spend a lot of money on that. And of course, house shows make sense because you can string them together and you can run a lot of them. It's the TV tapings that you really want to make sure that you're piling people into, specifically so you can have a hot crowd too. It really does make a difference on the full picture. So just from a quick WrestleNomics attendance standpoint, I thought that was really interesting. Obviously, they drew probably, 40-some thousand people for the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome, and it will be intriguing to see whether or not they break that out at all in the January results when we finally see those, or whether they just kind of leave it as a Q1 number, even though it's going to obviously be very distortive compared to any other event.
You convinced me that they wouldn't, because it's in January and it's not going to be, but it's not like in the future they're going to, they might run Royal Rumble again in the stadium, but it's not going to be jumping back and forth between quarters like WrestleMania does, which by the way, they do break out WrestleMania, because WrestleMania, you never know if it's going to be in March or in April. And that will determine whether it's going to be in Q1 or Q2. So, it makes it harder to compare.
And I think that's the key, is that's a great example of something that a investor really should ask, is to say, hey, I see your Q1 number, or your January, your Q1 number is really high for live event attendance domestically. Now, doesn't that include Royal Rumble? What would that number be without the Royal Rumble? And just something like that, I do think is a fair question to ask, because it is a distortive number in this. And we definitely see it with WrestleMania, just how distortive that can be. But 40,000 people.
We'll get a quarterly report, one of those notes underneath the live event section. The Royal Rumble drew X amount of paid attendance.
So I don't have a ton more of notes that I had. I think one note I had was there's 7,725 holders of record of Class A stock and 3 holders of record of Class B stock. So we know it's Vince McMahon and probably just those family trusts, I'm guessing, are the only things left, unless it's Stephanie or I don't even know if Hunter can technically hold that stock.
No, I don't think he can. I think the three are Vince, Linda, and Stephanie. Because Linda still has,
and I don't even know if Linda. I think Linda's getting rid of hers.
Last I checked, when I did all this research, like when she was nominated to be the SBA to go to the SBA, and she has like 550,000 shares of B stock. Stephanie has like 2 million, and Linda has like 35 million shares. So that was based on. I was going through a lot of SEC documents, and I contacted WWE, and because I was trying to also figure out whether or not Shane had any, and it appeared that he did not. And then to read that the other day, where it says there's only 3 holders of B stock, that seemed to tell me that Shane definitely doesn't have any. I was wondering if that had ever been stated like that before, that there's only 3 holders of B shares.
Well, every year they say how many holders there are, and in the past there's like 7 or 9, because there's a lot more trusts that were out there too. And the other thing is, Linda, when she was being confirmed to the SBA, she actually published an ethics document where she outlined what she was going to divest as if she were to be successful. And I thought she might have said she was getting rid of her WWE stock, but I could be wrong on that. I know she said she would not confer with the company on any of their business initiatives, which I don't think will be hard for her to walk away and stay away from. But I think your Shane note there is really important, because people still, I still talk to people who think Shane, because he is on SmackDown, is part of the executive structure for WWE. And it's hard to kind of get through people's skulls that no, Shane is not part of WWE from a corporate standpoint. He probably is not going to be in the near future here. And additionally, a lot of crazy stuff has been happening with his old company that used to be, what was it? Not You Shout, something like that. But they renamed themselves You On Demand. It's no longer You On Demand. It's now called WeCast. And they had a whole kerfuffle where they got rid of their CFO. But that stock shot up like 20% last week. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it was some crazy insider trading stuff, because it was not a very valuable stock, kind of a penny stock that was shooting up. But it was really intriguing to me that that his whole old operation here has actually been exploding lately in value. So he might finally actually make back all that money on the shares he gave them.
Executive? Is he still an employee with that company, or is, I think he's still on the board of directors, right? But is he doing anything when he's not appearing on WWE television?
As far as I know, he does not have a company position with WeCast, aka You on Demand, and he is on their board of directors. He was their former chairman. I think he's now the vice chairman because they basically got a superstar investor, and then he basically bought the chairmanship, and so now he is just a he's just the vice chairman, and he has all these loans to the company that they owe him, and so they might actually be paying them all back now. So kudos to him. I bet you anything he has his own production company, and he has his own sneaker company or something else out there. I don't think he is completely businessless.
That's the question.
Yeah, that was a fascinating disclosure, wasn't it? When the Vice article Ian Frisch wrote about that, and I spent a lot of time talking to Ian about stuff, and he just told me he had a couple juicy scoops, and that was one of his juicy scoops for sure. But I never knew about that before it happened, so I thought that was pretty cool. So I'm chatting here with Brandon Howard. You can call us at 646-668-2171. We're probably going to wrap it up soon, though, unless we have any other callers. What were some of the other things you were thinking about for 2017? Obviously, we're going to get more TV rights. We're going to have a lot more touring going on because SmackDown's going to be an independent brand for more than the year than it was a year prior. NXT has already shown that it can be a bigger brand. So we're going to see a ton of events. I mean, I think I calculated they ran 50 events in January. And, obviously... Wow. You're not going to always do that, but 50 times 12 is 600 events. So if you were to count everything, that's a heck of a lot. I don't think that's what they're going to do. I calculated they did 22 house shows in January. Yeah, it was 22 house shows of Raw and SmackDown, 11 apiece, TV tapings, and then 15 NXT and the two UK tournament shows. Excuse me. And the pay-per-view. So, I mean, it was an unusual month. But also, they run two pay-per-views most months. So it's not that different. Sometimes they cut back on house shows a little bit on the weeks that they're running pay-per-views. And obviously NXT gears up for quarterly stuff. So they're a little bit heavier once a quarter than they are the other months. So I do think maybe it might be a little heavier for NXT than normal, but still 50. It just kind of blew me away when I thought about that number. I thought, we're going back to the days of the 80s where they ran 600, 700 shows a year if they do that. And that's going to be a logistical nightmare just in terms of how many people you need.
Talking about on the conference call, the brand extension is going exactly how we thought it would. The big wheel keeps on turning. I think in 2017, they're going to run even more shows than they did in 2016. Obviously, like you're saying, they already ran 50 shows in January. We had that they projected they're going to make $100 million in EBITDA. I would say, considering how accurate they've been in their projections on network subscribers from quarter to quarter, that I think they've got a pretty reliable handle on making projections like that. So I think there's every reason to believe that they're probably going to make $100 million in EBITDA at the end of 2017. I was wondering.
They did throw out. About...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, they did throw out one statement, and I felt like it was one of these statements they say that they mean one thing and people interpret it a very different way, where he's talking about the success of 205 Live, which in itself is already comical, but the success of 205 Live and the cruiserweights. And then he said something like, we're going to be doing more touring with them. And people took that to mean that they're going to start doing independent cruiserweight show touring. And I'm pretty dubious of that. I think they're really just inferring that NXT is going to tour more and the cruiserweights might be part of that. But I don't think we're going to see a lot of independent 205. I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made that if you were taping 205 Live somewhere else besides SmackDown and you were doing it as an independent taping and you did it in a very small venue, you could kill it. If you're going to Rochester and Buffalo and you want to play, a 2,000-seat armory or a 1,000, you could fill it up. You could have a rabid crowd. You could make it awesome. But when you're playing a 5,000 people there for SmackDown, 1,000 leaving in a 12,000 seat arena, that's where the problem is right now. So if they are going to tour 205 Live, please God, I hope they have a plan where they're going to Helsinki or it's going to be on Iceland every week or something.
No, that's just Vince talking about how they're using all this talent in so many different ways and the brand what's allowing them to do so much. I know there's kind of a to-do about when WWE posts those most popular shows on the network every week, which I'm kind of dubious of, because, for one thing, it's just like a top 10 list, and there's no – who knows if there's any real metrics driving these things, or if they're just, you know, handpicked by somebody because they want these things to be watched by people. But anyway, there was kind of a to-do because 205 Live was, you know, dropping down in the rankings, and so presumably wasn't having very strong viewership, which of course WWE must be aware of if that's true, and would be very hesitant, I would think, to try to run independent 205 Live shows.
And the other part of it is, it's like Twitter trending, right? So there's a formula that says when the delta is so much, that's when you trend on Twitter. So when we say it's the hottest shows, you know, it could just be that the delta is this or that. So it's hard to say. Same thing, you know, I remember taking away this year's Royal Rumble. We had Goldberg, we had Lesnar, we had Undertaker. It'll be interesting to see if they have to make a financial disclosure about increased talent costs. Because in the past, when, for instance, The Rock was working, you know, with CM Punk, things like that, we would see a little disclosure basically saying that they had to pay out more on Royal Rumble fees. Because, hey, if you're going to put The Rock in, you got to pay him a lot of money and it's going to cut into your OBITDA. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Q1 has a note about, you know, maybe having to pay more for this quarter or not. So that's another thing for 2017. But the reason they can say they're going to hit $100 million is because so much of it is guaranteed in TV rights. And that's why it's so shocking when you think that 10 years ago, they almost hit $100 million and they had nowhere close to that TV revenue. And so from a, you know, you could say from a sheer momentum standpoint, from an interest standpoint, if you're just hitting your same revenue number now, but now so much of it's coming guaranteed, it's frightening to think about what that says about the interest level of your product today. China's going to save everything. We know that.
I was just looking at the big, of course. I was just looking at the big master trending schedule before calling in. And you look at TV rights revenue, or TV, I think it's TV rights OBITDA, right? And if you give them the TV rights OBITDA that they had in like 2013 before they made the deals, it's something like, I don't know, $65 million or something like that. If you stretch that across every year after 2014, like this company would be making like $20 million in OBITDA. So they would be like, you know, a fifth as profitable. So to give you an idea of just how much TV rights, you know, help this company out and float them.
I mean, from a profit standpoint, they've pretty much doubled their OBITDA on television rights. And if you had OBITDA on your bingo square right now, you've won. They pretty much doubled since 2014. And that's shocking when you think about it, that in 2 years you could make that division twice as profitable as it was. But that's how much of a step change it was when they did their renegotiation, because they went from 62 million OBITDA in 2014 to 120 million OBITDA this year. And even higher if you – or, yeah, a little bit different if you include that $15 million cost one way or the other way. But I thought it was just fascinating just how much money they're making on that. We can talk about WWE results all day long. If you are interested in them, go to corporate.wwe.com, check out the investors link, and they have lots of stuff there. Or go to sec.gov, type in company finder WWE, look at the things there. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Mookie Ghana. You can follow Brandon at Decorative Drop. Brandon, do you got any articles you're working on right now for Fightful?
I'm working on an article so I wrote an article a couple of days ago, just a report of sort of what came out of the earnings report, and I'm working on another one right now with some actual analysis and predictions. Before we go, do you have a prediction on WrestleMania subs, free and or paid?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I'm going to have to, you know, they did say that they're going to hold a call the day after WrestleMania so that they can give us the WrestleMania numbers, which is good because they've been doing that in the past. And I think, you know, they would feel like if they didn't do that, that would cause a huge problem. I'm trying to buy time right now where I pull up last year's WrestleMania numbers so I can just look again at exactly what they were. You know, I have like the numbers from 2014 blazoned in my head, but I struggle now with you know, where we were in 2016. So do you have it on the top of your head?
Last year paid was 1,454,000 with 370,000 free. So a total of like over 1.8 million.
1.824, yeah. So we're obviously going to kill the 1.454 number because we're at that now today, and that's pre-WrestleMania bump. So, you know, what are you going to be at that's higher than that? Well, they basically grew about 130,000 last year 2015 to 2016. And that was on the backs of that free WrestleMania campaign where you had so many people sitting in that other bucket. So if you were to say you can recapture that, I'm feeling like maybe 1.62 would be the day of type number. Yeah. But, you know,
maybe 1.9 with free. I wonder if they're going to maybe there's an internal goal for like 2 million free NPs.
That's, you know, that's certainly the challenge. I would almost say at this point, if you're WWE and you just got the stock bump that you got now, if you go out there and you send out a press release saying you hit 2 million and then it turns out that it's all free, your stock's going to fall through the floor. So I think they got to be really careful with what they do on that, because I do think that people are going to see through the smoke and mirrors on that, because it's great to say 1.8 because that's a number that everyone can believe. But the moment you start talking about 2 million at this point, people very quickly say, well, that sounds funny. And then they look into it. So I think there's kind of a liar's credibility that you can exceed that threshold. And then it's very dangerous for you. And that's the danger that WWE has, in my opinion. So, but you're right. They mail.
There's been a credibility problem with this company for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds about right. But, well, I'm glad you called in. Some reason having you call in helped my voice quite a lot. Don't know whether that was the drugs, the dogs, the alcohol, what it was speaking, but my voice is improving by a lot. So I'm going to sign off now. We got a good hour 40 of this, and this will probably be uploaded to voicesofwrestling.com, where both friends of the site and constituents of Illinois and Texas, respectively, from some constituents in New York and a constituent in Minnesota, we bid everyone adieu. Thank you so much for calling in, Brandon. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Why pay hundreds more in taxes and fees on your wireless bill? Introducing T-Mobile One, now with taxes and fees included. Get four lines for $40 each per month with AutoPay. Switch your family of four to T-Mobile and get a $600 prepaid card. It's kind of like a refund on the taxes and fees you paid to those other guys last year. Don't wait. Visit a T-Mobile store.
Top 3% of data users greater than 28 gigabytes per month may notice reduced speeds. Sales tax and regulatory fees included. Effective with February charges via prepaid MasterCard card. See store for details.
Why pay hundreds more in taxes and fees on your wireless bill? Introducing T-Mobile One, now with taxes and fees included. Get four lines for $40 each per month with AutoPay. Switch your family of four to T-Mobile and get a $600 prepaid card. It's kind of like a refund on the taxes and fees you paid to those other guys last year. Don't wait. Visit a T-Mobile store.
Top 3% of data users greater than 28 gigabytes per month may notice reduced speeds. Sales tax and regulatory fees included. Effective with February charges via prepaid MasterCard card. See store for details.